Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special edition of Your Call and our media roundtable. At 9 o'clock this morning, Donald Trump officially became the 45th president of the United States. He's taking office with the lowest approval ratings in modern times. Today, we are spending the hour talking about freedom of the press, which many journalists say is under attack. Over the course of the campaign, Donald Trump got close to $2 billion worth of mostly uncritical free media attention. But near the end of the campaign, and after his Electoral College victory, that all changed. After BuzzFeed printed those unverified documents about Donald Trump recently, he called the network a failing pile of garbage. And then you might remember that at his first press conference, he refused to take a question from a CNN reporter calling the network a disgrace. The Committee to Protect Journalists and other organizations are calling Donald Trump a threat to the freedom of the press. So how are journalists responding to this, and how are they preparing for the next 4 years? Joining us today are three journalists. David Talbot is a journalist and author of several books, including his most recent, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David was on a few months ago talking about his book, and you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. David founded the online news site Salon, and is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. His column runs there 3 times a week. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here on this strange day.
Thank you. It's great to have you. I've been enjoying your columns. We're also joined by Craig Aaron, president of Free Press, an organization that works to change media and technology policy, promotes the public interest, and strengthen democracy. For more than a decade, Craig has led major campaigns to safeguard net neutrality, to stop media mergers and consolidation, and to oppose unchecked surveillance. Hi, Craig. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And Mark Danner is a veteran journalist who has written about foreign affairs for more than 3 decades. He's covered wars and political conflicts in Central America, Haiti, the Balkans, Iraq, and the Middle East. Mark is professor of journalism and English at UC Berkeley and the author of several books, including his most recent, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. This is an excellent book. In fact, we've had Mark on, I think, twice to talk about this. And you can also find that at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. I'm sitting in a cab on the way from the inauguration, so maybe a bit noisy, I'm afraid.
Well, thanks for joining us from a cab, Mark. Since we all watched it on TV or heard it on the radio, you were there. What is your overall assessment?
Well, I think it was a pretty successful event. You know, it was odd to me, having attended a number of his rallies, which were unforgettable events, to see the kind of mixing of his crowd with the rather more staid inauguration strictures that have grown up around the histories of inauguration. And you had definitely this resistance of thousands of people shouting Trump, 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 USA, USA, shouting lock her up when Hillary appeared on the dais, and booing, of course, Chuck Schumer, Senator Chuck Schumer. So this was a rather unusual event because you had all these people who came, you know, very much thinking they were part of the rebellion against Washington, and Donald Trump gave them a speech that was very much directed to them, it seemed to me. I thought it was an extremely effective speech. The other thing to note is it started to rain precisely at the moment he started to speak. It was quite remarkable. Hmm. I mean, everyone was waiting for the rain. It held off, it held off, it held off, and really at Trump's very first words, it started to rain.
Wow.
But I thought the event, you know, was pretty successful, and he gave a speech that, you know, it was kind of his populist red meat. And anybody who thought that you'd get a different Trump rhetorically on Inauguration Day from what he was during the campaign was very much disappointed, I think.
Craig, you're also in D.C., and you work to change media and technology, to safeguard net neutrality. You work to strengthen the freedom of the press. Given your role, what were you looking for today, and what did you think of what we saw this morning, what we heard?
Well, I heard a commenter on CNN right after the speech say, well, he didn't attack the press, words in his inaugural speech, and they were taking that as some kind of sign of progress. I think that sort of indicates, you know, what we expect, which is really a wholesale attack on any of the progress that was made during the Obama administration in terms of media and telecommunications policy. And there were some important decisions made. I think they're going to try to undermine those. The word just came out that Ajit Pai, who's been one of the commissioners, is going to take over the FCC. He's been an opponent of, you know, any consumer protections, really. And in terms of freedom of the press, you know, I think we saw, you know, we've seen it in the press conference that he had right before the inauguration last week. You know, there, I think there's going to be real danger and a real attempt to continue to use the press as a punching bag for as long as it works. And in an effort to really isolate and undermine anybody doing really serious critical reporting. So that's what we're preparing for, is really having to resist and expose and call out what this new administration keeps telling us they're going to do.
Since you mentioned net neutrality, can you briefly tell us what you think is going to happen with net neutrality? Senator Ted Cruz has called it Obamacare for the Internet. And so, and also, just for people who aren't aware, just a quick overview of what net neutrality is and why it's so important.
Sure. Well, net neutrality is this fundamental protection that makes sure when you go online, you can do whatever you want, go wherever you want, download whatever you want, and it's not up to your phone or cable company to decide which websites or online services are going to work and which won't. And back in 2015, the Obama administration, after a huge political public outcry, actually passed really strong net neutrality rules. And the Trump administration has lifted that up already as a target. So I think they are going to try to undo those rules. Or they're going to first, what they're going to do is try to ask Congress to rewrite them. And if they don't do that, they may begin a process to just simply try to unwind them. Now, that's not going to be, that's harder to do than to say. But we expect that they'll be, you know, really from day one, trying to go after one of the major accomplishments of the Obama administration, really the signature accomplishment of the FCC during this time. And, you know, we're very concerned about it. A world without net neutrality is a world where big companies get to pick and choose what's out there and give preferential treatment to the voices and the news outlets that they want. You do away without it, lots of independent voices and really anybody who's out there with a better idea, a new product they want to build, it gets that much harder to do. So we think it's a really important thing to fight for. We intend to do that, but we do expect this administration, maybe in a matter of days, will begin their attempt to first ignore and then dismantle those rules.
Wow. Craig Aaron is president of Free Press. David Talbot, you focus on the CIA. You write extensively about the deep state. What were you looking for this morning? What's your reaction?
Well, my reaction was similar to Mark's. I thought it was an incredibly effective speech to his populist base. That's why he was where he was today. And he didn't, pull any punches. I think the challenge now is for the Democratic Party. Frankly, we have to see a Democratic Party that's going to be, not a corporate party, but a party that's fighting for the interests of its the traditional working base. And he stole that base during this election. He was able to portray, for some obvious reasons, Hillary Clinton as a pawn of Wall Street interests and so on. And so I'm looking at a very fractured American establishment. I'm looking at a man who's establishing basically a one-man rule in many ways. He's at odds with his own party, which, of course, is also enthralled by corporate interests. Now, while he's posing, of course, as a populist, it's, you know, essentially a phony populism, because he's also installing, in direct control of government agencies, a number of corporate figures. So essentially, under the guise of populism, he's establishing a corporate estate. So it's up to the Democratic Party and to, you know, the popular opposition to that, whatever that is, whatever shape that takes, that Bernie-crats within the Democratic Party and leftists and progressive outside the party, to establish a compelling alternative to that story, to that narrative, and say, no, Donald Trump is offering you a phony populism that will only transfer more wealth to the hands of the 1%. And what we need to is show that, you know, an alternative vision that, that presents a very different future for America.
Well, and it's also the responsibility of the media to give people this information and to expose the truth about these policies and how they will affect people. And Mark, what are your thoughts? I mean, in the aftermath of the election, we read so many commentaries by media outlets, journalists, including the Columbia Journalism Review, ProPublica, the New York Times. I mean, editors went on Meet the Press to talk about the mistakes they made and how they're going to move forward. So what are your thoughts about this? How do you think the media are going to deal with Donald Trump, a hostile president, in his treatment of the media? He says he's not going to give them access, or he's going to choose who gets to be in the room. He uses Twitter to insult them. He wouldn't take a question from CNN at his first press conference. Are the media equipped to deal with this, and how should they deal with this?
Well, I would say no, they're not equipped to deal with it. you know, he revealed something very basic during the campaign, particularly during the during the primary campaign, which is that the American press, particularly the broadcast press, is a commercial press. And though it supposedly makes its editorial decisions based on editorial, strictly editorial concerns, what's newsworthy and so on, in fact, if you look at the campaign, you see decisions being made again and again because of ratings. And Donald Trump was terrific ratings. You know, Les Moonves, the president of CBS, in an unguarded moment said, Donald Trump may not be good for the country, but he's terrific for CBS News. I think that the American press is not equipped to deal with someone who, first of all, attacks them directly, attacks their objectivity, says they're essentially in the pocket of the elite, the corrupt elite, and continues to direct that kind of barrage of criticism at them day after day, appealing both to his base and to people who, you know, historically haven't trusted the media anyway.
Right.
I mean, in one sense, this is a continuation of the kind of fragmentation of the media environment that's been going on for quite a while. It's also a extension of something that started to happen during the George W. Bush administration. You remember the famous quote about the reality-based community that probably came from Karl Rove, that we're an empire now and we change reality. So people who are in the reality-based community are actually behind the fact that with our great power we can change the way things are. You know, you have a very basic argument about truth and about facts, and Donald Trump is a remarkable phenomenon in that he is perfectly willing to get up and say from his campaign and now from the White House itself things that are demonstrably untrue. And when he is called out on them, he repeats them, and he repeats them again, and they become part of his talking points, and it doesn't matter that those facts are disproven. And this, to me, is an enormous challenge for the press. I mean, you ask what the press should do about it. I think they have to double down on reporting on facts.
And can I add also one other thing?
Boilerplate again and again that this is not true, what he said, and this is true. And, you know, you have to try not to battle him directly, but try to report what is a factual matter and what is not. And you have to cling to that, I think. And whether the press will have the discipline to do that, I don't know.
David, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing to Mark's points, which is the press also has to get over this arrogant sense of itself as an institution that's part of power, that enjoys access on a routine basis to power. And so there was all this kerfuffle over whether or not the White House, the press was going to be able to keep its White House press room. You know, well, real journalists, independent journalists, muckraking journalists like I.F. Stone, who was in the Washington, you know, press culture for many years, he didn't worry about that. In fact, he thought that journalists shouldn't have that kind of routine access to the parties in power, and he never went to them. And yet you have something like the Newseum, which was started by the Gannett Corporation, USA Today, and all that, you know, this elite institution that celebrates its own self, the Fourth Estate there in Washington. It threw this lavish inaugural party, charging people, I think, $500 a head to go to it, and they sold out in more ways than one. So here's the press supposedly, maintaining an advocate, or rather impartial and contrarian, stance. At the same time, it's part of the celebration that's going on now during the Washington coronation of Trump. So the press has to decide where it really is at this point. And I think the New York Times and the Washington Post and other papers, to their credit, decided that this was such an unusual development, political development, the rise of Donald Trump during the campaign, that they did abandon their impartiality and sort of, you know, the traditional neutrality that the press is supposed to maintain during the campaign in great alarm, and started to very aggressively and in an imbalanced way go after Trump. And I think that has to continue if we're going to maintain our American democracy, because this is not a normal presidency we're seeing. These are not normal times, and the press has to be much more, I think, aggressive than it's been in the past.
And
could I add something to that?
Sure, Mark.
I agree with everything David just said very astutely. I just have to add, though, that trading access for information is kind of the way that the elite press has worked in covering politics. And the fact is that the Trump campaign and now the Trump presidency is absolutely ruthless on shutting down access. I mean, they actually, during the campaign, denied the credentials of the Washington Post, one of two or three most important newspapers in the country. I mean, after writing some critical things, I had my credentials denied and have had to go to these things without press credentials. This is a very effective strategy because essentially, people make careers in journalism by covering a particular beat and cultivating sources. And if those sources deny information or deny recognition or deny credentials, this is extremely effective kind of leverage.
But we're talking about two different things.
I agree with what David was saying, but I think one can't underestimate what a revolutionary change this will be in how we're covering the administration, because this trading of access and information is simply the way it's been done for decades. And we're entering really a new, very new world here, and no one knows what it's going to look like.
Hmm. Craig, Aaron, what would you add?
Well, I definitely agree with a lot of what's been said, and I mean, this is really one of these moments of truth. All these journalists who got into this game because they watched All the President's Men or whatever it was that inspired them to take up probably a pen and paper originally. It was supposedly to be able to respond to moments like this. And I think that test is coming. I don't know that anyone's passing it yet, but this is also a moment where I think journalists need to be thinking about solidarity. What are they going to do when the president, if we're talking about on the access side, shouts down and refuses to take questions from a CNN? What is CNN going to do? Are they going to spend their time saying, we're not BuzzFeed? Or are they going to actually step up? And are we going to see who's actually going to invest in investigators instead of access? All these television networks have completely gutted and cut their reporting ranks. They've got bookers, they've got shouting heads, they're spending money on the Corey Lewandowskis and Jeffrey Lords of the world at a moment when we need them to get back to hiring serious investigative reporters and going where access isn't the issue. And I think journalists are really facing a moment where, as was suggested by my colleagues here, everything has changed and they need to change, and they need to be in these fights with the Trump administration, I think, asking themselves a little bit less, like, well, how do we get people to care about us? and more, how do we do the work that shows the public that we're actually on their side? And I think that's why Trump's attacks work. People have gotten fed up with the press for good reason, because of how they've covered their communities, because of the kind of horse race coverage that's been fed to them election after election. That trust has broken down, and Donald Trump is exploiting it. The only way to get it back is to do the really serious local work and in-depth work. I think IF Stone's a great model for any journalist, and we're going to need a lot of IF Stones in the years ahead.
Craig Aaron is president of Free Press, an organization that focuses on strengthening democracy and sustaining quality journalism. David Talbot is writing a column now for the San Francisco Chronicle. It runs three times a week. He's author of The Devil's Chessboard. And Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. His latest book is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And this is a special edition of Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you talking about the role the media played in the last year, and then what we should expect from journalists covering someone like Donald Trump, who's very hostile, has a hostile relationship with the media. What are your thoughts? 866-798-8255. You've got three journalists on. Craig Aaron focuses on strengthening journalism. So if you have any questions or comments for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. And then also, we're going to talk about President Obama's legacy with the media. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. All week, we've been doing a series on President Obama's legacy and what he's leaving for Donald Trump. We focused on foreign policy, the economy, the environment, and immigration. And we wanted to talk about media. And James Risen, an investigative journalist with The New York Times, had a piece recently called If Donald Trump Targets Journalists, Thank Obama. And he writes, criticism of Obama's stance on press freedom, government transparency, and secrecy is hotly disputed by the White House, but many journalism groups say the record is clear. Over the past 8 years, the Obama administration has prosecuted 9 cases involving whistleblowers and leakers, compared with only 3 by all previous administrations combined. It has repeatedly used the Espionage Act, a relic of World War I era red baiting, not to prosecute spies, but to go after government officials who talk to journalists. And James Risen knows this firsthand because the administration tried to get him to testify to reveal his confidential sources in a criminal leak investigation. The DOJ relented, but it won a 7-year court battle that went all the way to the Supreme Court to try to force James Risen to testify. So, Mark Danner, what about this? How would you grade President Obama and his crackdown, his relationship with the media, but also the crackdown on journalists?
Well, I think, you know, he was unprecedentedly ruthless. The Justice Department was unprecedentedly ruthless in using the 1917 Espionage Act, which was Woodrow Wilson's very ill-considered act that could have long since been appealed against leakers, for which it's completely inappropriate. And he won decisions. And, you know, I agree completely that it sets a very evil precedent. There's no question about it. And this should be, you know, included when we think about President Obama's record. I have to add, though, just to pick up something you said a moment ago, Rose, you were talking about Trump's hostile relationship with the press, and we have been dwelling on that. But it's important to say that this is a kind of Janus-based phenomenon here that looks in both directions. He may have a hostile relationship with some members of the press, but the press has made him.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talked about his ratings and the fact that, you know, he ran this historic campaign that spent relatively little on the media and depended entirely on free media. And the extent to which he dominates the airwaves and is able to master the news cycle is absolutely unprecedented. Nobody has achieved anything like him when it comes to his wall-to-wall press coverage. And, you know, when we talk about the challenge of journalism, it's not only now to cover him in a critical way, it's also to not let him dominate coverage with trivialities, which is basically what he does. I mean, his Twitter, you know, his tweeting is essentially a way to dominate news cycles after news cycles with relatively trivial feuds at the same time as he's doing things that are much more important in the background. And we see this phenomenon already during the transition. And the question is whether the press is going to have the discipline to actually cover the important and the latest tweet storm in which President Trump is attacking somebody. You know, it has to do with the seriousness of the press as well. So it isn't just a hostile relationship with the press. It's the necessity to bring editorial judgment to what the president says.
Yes, and we'll talk more about that after the break. Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. Sorry about his bad phone line there, but he is in a cab. He just left the inauguration in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by David Talbot. He's writing a column with for the San Francisco Chronicle. It runs three times a week. And Craig Aaron is president of Free Press. This is a special edition of Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
Special Inauguration Day extra edition of Your Call here on KLW. We appreciate your calls. We rely on engaged listeners for the show. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. You can always post a comment or question at Your Call Radio or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's a special edition of our media roundtable. We're speaking today with three journalists about Donald Trump, about the inauguration, and about what we should expect from the media in the coming months. Mark Danner is a veteran journalist, author of the book Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Craig Aaron is president of Free Press, an organization that works to change media and technology policy and also promotes quality journalism. David Talbot is a journalist. He writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle. It runs three times a week. And his latest book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David, we'll talk in a couple minutes about Mark's important comment about the media focusing on the tweets. At the same time, other really important things are happening. But I wanted to get your take on President Obama and how you grade his relationship with the media, his crackdown on whistleblowers. And the New York Times' James Risen, an investigative reporter, called the Obama White House the most anti-press administration since Richard Nixon.
Well, I think Barack Obama will go down in history as someone who was very sophisticated, very intelligent leader, who was very eloquent in addressing some of the fundamental problems with the American experiment, i.e. racism and so on, but really accepted sort of the basic parameters of power, and i.e. Wall Street, the national security state, and learned to play ball with those people and not bring any of the people who committed crimes within those worlds to justice and so on. And so I think the rising sort of fury from the American heartland and from working families all across the country who have sacrificed their sons and daughters to these permanent wars we have in the Middle East and saw no justice when their homes were foreclosed on and so on. I mean, you know, so he has to, as Mark said, answer for that in, you know, historically. And in some ways, the Obama and Clinton years paved the way for this disaster now that we're seeing unfolding in Washington. Can I just add one other point, I think, Rose, to this discussion, which is this. It's also very important as we go forward for how the media covers the protest movements and the resistance that's been building now against Trump. For instance, this morning I watched the coverage for, you know, well over an hour. You know, Mark was there, and there were, you know, violent protests in the streets of Washington as, you know, the events on stage were unfolding. But it took a long time before MSNBC finally cut away from its bubble, where the TV, you know, talking heads kept celebrating the so-called peaceful transition of power. Well, it was anything but peaceful today, and it's going to get less peaceful, I think, as the day goes on. There have been a number of arrests here in San Francisco in the streets. This is a country that's bitterly, bitterly divided. And in fact, as we well know, he lost the popular vote by, you know, nearly 3 million votes. Mm-hmm. So this is not going to be a calm transition, here. And whether is the establishment press thinking that it needs to somehow shore up people's confidence in authority and in our government? If so, they're going to continue to play in the hands of Trump as this sort of elite apparatus that doesn't really care about what's happening in the streets.
Reuters is reporting that right now police and riot gear are responding to protests with tear gas and stun grenades. And we're going to do a show about protests on Monday. And we will talk more about the protests later in the show. But Craig, I just wanted to get back to Obama because after tomorrow, or today, I should say, I think we're going to focus so much on Donald Trump. And I just think it's important for people to know about the groundwork that was laid for Donald Trump with Obama going after whistleblowers, for example. Can you talk about this? His administration prosecuted 9 cases involving whistleblowers and leakers, compared with 3 by all previous administrations combined.
Yeah, it was really remarkable, and I think James Risen's comparison is apt, that we really hadn't seen anything since the Nixon era. And here at the end, you know, facing a Donald Trump presidency with Obama saying, you know, really nice things about the press and their importance of being in the building, it can be very easy to forget how aggressive they were at going after, especially the leakers themselves, who faced, you know, really sort of an unprecedented level of legal attacks for trying to speak out about things that were going on in the administration, and really eroding those journalist protections and putting incredible amount of pressure. You know, James Risen was someone who was ultimately backed by the New York Times and able to withstand that for the most part, but, you know, others aren't going to have that luxury. And so I think with the Obama administration, you did see them putting into place things you are now going to see the next administration abuse, just like George W. Bush put things in a place that Obama abused. And the massive expansion of the surveillance state is one of those things. And so for all the Obama supporters who are unwilling to speak out about the expansion of that surveillance state, who didn't think the Edward Snowden revelations were a big deal because it was their guy in the White House, and that absolutely happened. There are a lot of Democrats who refused to speak out during that time. They're now going to, you know, reap from what happened at that time, and see those same tools put in the hands of Donald Trump and Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon and everybody else who's coming into this administration. And I think that is a very, very, harrowing, moment.
Craig Aaron is president of Free Press. David Talbot writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. This is a special edition of Your Calls Media Roundtable. And if you'd like to share your views on the media, you've got 3 journalists on the line. We do a show every day. What do you want from the media in the coming months when it comes to Donald Trump? 866-798-8255. I mean, we're already seeing some major changes. Hopefully we can talk about this, but major budget cuts are coming. And then when it comes to public lands, there's some major news about that. So first, let's kick it off with Kim in Berkeley. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
I just wanted to check in because my concern is about the media, my perception of the media's inability to talk about race in the upcoming 4 years of Trump. And my example of that is that when Obama ran for president, it was like, yes, we have the first African-American president. How does that feel for the African-American community? How is that going to impact African-Americans? What does that do for African-American youth and around then moving forward? But as we're moving forward with Trump, there's this inability to talk about white Americans. And instead, what we get is the people, our country, Americans. When he's not talking about Americans, he's talking about white people, and specifically he's talking about white rural people. And I think it's really unfortunate if we're now going to move into a situation where when we're talking about a specific subgroup of white people, instead of calling it for what it is, we just say Americans. And I think that that is an inability from the media to really address issues of race. And I just would like to hear your comments.
All right. Well, we talk about this on a regular basis. And David, you focus on this and think about these issues. What's your response?
You know, Trump made a stab at addressing the racial divide when he said we all, no matter what our color, in his inaugural address today, we all bleed patriotic red, and that was about as far as he went there. He also, I think, degraded and caricatured black communities by talking about, you know, the gangs and the drugs and the carnage there, as if these are, violent battlegrounds on a daily basis. And we know that overall crime has actually gone down, during the Obama years and so on. So racism is a huge component of the Trump revolution, whether or not, they want to acknowledge that. And in fact, they're not just declaring the Trump people war on the press, they're declaring war on Black Lives Matter. And I just interviewed Alicia Garza recently, one of the leaders of that movement, and they're obviously very concerned about what's going to be coming down on them. And the press has a duty to cover that repression as well, and to be very alert to those sorts of violations of civil liberties that we're going to be seeing on an official basis. I lived through the Nixon years. And we can see what an administration with the full powers of the federal state can do when it comes to cracking down on people who are activists and challenging authority. And it was pretty ugly and brutal during those Nixon years. And I hope that we don't see a revival of that under Trump. But I'm afraid because of the rhetoric that he himself has been using to vilify black activists and so on during his campaign, we are indeed going to see some ugly things in the future.
We're just getting word that nearly 100 people have been arrested at the inauguration so far. And speaking of crackdowns, The Intercept ran a story recently about Republican lawmakers in 5 states proposing legislation to criminalize peaceful protests. Mark Danner, what are your thoughts on media coverage of race with Donald Trump in the White House?
Excuse me, I'm getting out of this cab.
Mark Danner's at a cab. He just left the inauguration in Washington.
I'm out of the cab now,
okay.
Thank goodness. I'd say, first of all, that it's absolutely true that American politics, more than ever, or certainly more than any time since the Civil War, are kind of swinging back and forth on the fulcrum of race. And, I just attended this inaugural, having attended Obama's 8 years before, and there are 2 major differences I noticed. One is that it was incredibly cold during Obama's, and at least not so cold this time. And secondly, this was all white faces. Obama's was a complete mixture, and a lot of black faces, and there were none here. It was white. And you get just a vivid sense, this was true at his rallies as well, of how divided the country is and how polarized it is, and how it is polarized across, along racial lines. There's no question about that. When it comes to the press covering it, I have to agree that there should be more attention to this, but I'm not quite sure where the failure lies. The fact is that we have to figure out ways to talk about these issues short of simply calling the administration racist. We have a problem. During the campaign, there's a tradition in this country of so-called dog whistling. That is, particularly on the Republican side, ads and rhetoric point to racial issues in a kind of winking way without explicitly going there. The Willie Horton ad by George H.W. Bush is the best example of that, saying, vote for Bush or else he's black criminals are going to come and get you. What's unusual when it comes to Trump is he doesn't dog whistle. He's simply explicit when he refers, for example, to the other as Mexican immigrants, Mexican illegals. He did it in a way that is in a strange way hard to report on. You simply say what he says. You show what he says. It's pretty explicitly racist. And then what else do you do? In other words, there's a sense in which because he is explicit and not dog whistling, there's no real way to explain it. You're showing him adopting, in effect, racist attitudes, racist positions, and he won. He managed to win. He got fewer votes, but he managed to win the electoral vote. So I guess my question back to the caller is, what more should the press actually be doing? In a sense, he is actually saying things explicitly in a way that we have not seen politicians in this country do before. I mean, you have to go back to George Wallace in 68 and 72 to see anything like this. And he's not only explicit, but he's effective. He proved it to be effective with his voters.
And Craig, Mark brought up a good point earlier about how the media are so focused on the tweets, and that becomes the story of the day. Now that Trump is officially president, things are going to move really quickly. In fact, just yesterday or 2 days ago, The Hill had a piece about these drastic cuts that are coming. The Departments of Commerce and Energy are going to see major reductions in funding. Programs might be eliminated altogether. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting would be privatized, according to this piece. The National Endowment for the Arts would be eliminated altogether, along with a number of violence against women programs. They might be all cut. The Guardian is reporting that lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, have quietly laid the foundation to give away Americans' birthright, 640 million acres of national land. So things are going to move very quickly in the coming weeks. How do you think journalists should focus on all of these very important issues?
It's a great question, and activists really are facing a lot of the same challenges because the strategy of the Trump administration is to flood the zone, do as many things at the same time. You know, all these different completely unqualified nominees going out for positions at the same time, who can even keep track? That's what they're counting on. And I think that is the real danger of the Trump administration in so many ways, is that while, you know, Trump himself is tweeting or zeroing in on one company or one person, I've heard it compared to like the Eye of Sauron from The Lord of the Rings. Like when he's looking right at you, it's a really big deal. But when he's not looking there, so much is happening in the shadows. And that's how Congress is proceeding, and that's how lobbyists are proceeding. They're proceeding here in town like, let's get whatever we can until the wheels fall off. So they've completely put all of their agendas forward, and they're going to try to do as much simultaneously. I think this gets back to the earlier call. I think it was David talking about it, of why this is why reporters need to get out of those briefing rooms. They need to get away from the press conferences, and they need to start digging in and exposing. We have seen in these early days that some of this stuff can be disrupted. The House ethics scandal with Congress, you know, teeing that up right away. Let's get rid of the House ethics office. They had to roll that back. We're going to have to do that. And those of us who work on individual issues, you know, I pay attention to media. I'm really concerned about privatizing the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and things like that. You know, there's going to be a day that's going to be the issue, but we have to be prepared to work on a number of these other issues and against these other nominees at the same time. And I think that requires the media, the same rules don't apply, and they need to be spending a lot more time outside. And that even gets to the last caller. The media's responsibility here really to go out and understand the impact of this administration and its decisions on real people's lives, and especially on black and brown people's lives, who have been treated as this sort of like anonymous voting block. As soon as the election happened, everybody scrambled around to say like, oh my gosh, maybe what the problem was, we didn't understand white people. I think we were understanding them pretty well from the results of this election. There are these incredible social movements that have been happening over the last couple of years. That's where the change is going to come. That's where the resistance is going to come from. And frankly, that's the force that's been changing how many news organizations are approaching issues of race and issues of social justice. So I think we need a lot more focus there, a lot less focused on who showed up to which inaugural ball or what have you. And that is the challenge the media is going to face, because there is a lot of bad stuff that's going to happen in very dark corners. And that's actually where we need journalists. When journalists show they can do that, I think they'll actually find that the public is with them in ways that they haven't been before.
And David, ProPublica is keeping track of websites and the text on the websites and how they're changing. And this just happened within the last hour, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration website has already changed. We're going to look for the text. Also, the White House website has removed climate change and LGBT pages. The text says, for too long, we've been held back by burdensome regulations on our energy industry. Trump is committed to eliminating harmful and unnecessary policies as the climate action plan. Lifting these restrictions will help workers increase wages by $30 billion. So they're changing websites already.
Yeah, no, this is going to be a revolution, and a revolution that we're not going to be happy with. This is an assault on the environment. It's an assault on working people, and it's an assault on people of color across the board. And it's a phony populism, as I said earlier. It's a corporate takeover of America, of the American arms, of various arms of government. He's installing people like Rex Tillerson, head of Exxon, directly in charge of foreign policy. He's installing, number of bankers and industrialists directly in charge of government agencies that supposedly regulate those industries. I mean, there's no fig leaf anymore. They used to have like at least someone who had sort of a veneer of neutrality, but now it's a complete naked sort of what David Brooks called savage capitalism takeover of American government. And I just want to, underline the importance of what Craig just said. I think it's vital, therefore, for the press to get outside of its safe zone, get into the streets, go into these communities that are being so harshly impacted by these policies or will be. You know, Bobby Kennedy, when he was senator from New York, had one last desperate meeting with President Johnson trying to persuade him to take a different course from the disastrous course in Vietnam he was on and so on, and destroying the Democratic Party. And afterwards, he was very disappointed. He came back to his Senate office. He realized LBJ was not going to alter his course, and he told his Senate staff, Kennedy, to hell with it. He said, let's go start our own country. Well, that's really the spirit, I think, of many, many millions of people now across the country. We've seen a hostile takeover, corporate takeover of Washington today, and what we need to do is start our own country, in effect, build our own organizations, build our own resistance, community by community across this country, and that is going to be a fascinating story that the press must and should cover.
We have a time for one more caller before we have to end. Let's go to David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi. Hi, Rose. My question, of course, is about NPR, not your program, because I find yours outstanding. In fact, the Ethics Committee question where they tried to eliminate it, NPR, not Rose Aguilar, but NPR had interviewed a senator on their morning show. And I know a lot of these people are listening to NPR, hear these one-liners that were falsehoods coming out of the senator's mouth, who's saying that it's conducted much like a McCarthyite system, that you don't know who the accusers are. And we know that's not true. In fact, Rose pointed out with some Minnesota legislators that she interviewed that really highlighted the reason for why we needed the Ethics Committee. And yet, NPR did not follow up and pursue that falsehood that the senator had elicited on the radio on this early morning program. Mm-hmm. And people are driving to work, they hear this one-liner, and they think it's true.
Do you remember who the senator was? I didn't hear that.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'll try to email you on it, but it almost made me believe it was true, the way they fed it through.
Well, thank you for that.
You're
I think
welcome.
It's such a good point. And
I'll let you go.
Thank you. David or Mark or Craig, I watched the hearings very closely, and I noticed that a lot of mostly Republican politicians did lie about a lot of things. They put out misinformation about a number of issues. And so this has been getting a lot of attention. The editor of the Wall Street Journal was on Meet the Press saying that the paper is not going to to call a lie a lie. They will present both sides of the story and then let the readers decide. The editor of the New York Times said that they will use the lie word lie, but use it sparingly. Mark Danner, this is an important conversation we need to have right now.
It's extremely important. The press traditionally doesn't like to use the word lie because it seems to suggest that they know what's in the person's head. That is, there's something presumptuous about it. Usually they'll report what's said and then report something else that will show that this is at variance with the truth. But only really, so far as I can tell, in the Trump era, have we started to use lie, falsely, and other things like that, actually in headlines, which the New York Times did. But, you know, this is couldn't be more important because this is a struggle over what is a fact exactly. And one of the things that I think Trump has shown is that he can be corrected again and again. He can it can be reported again and again that what he said, for example, about Muslims celebrating in Jersey City, the 9/11 attacks, can be shown repeatedly to be false, but he will double down on it and repeat it. And I think that's going to become a trademark of the administration. And this presents very difficult, I think, problems for journalists because there is an assumption usually that if someone gets something wrong and it's pointed out that they get something wrong, that they will bow to the fact. And this administration explicitly does not do that. And they seem to believe, you know, this is, it's not new with them. I mean, I hate to refer to Joseph Goebbels, but I can't help it because it's too apropos. You know, the propaganda minister said, if you say it and say it again and say it again, it becomes true. And that seems to be partly their motto.
Take a breath, Mark. David, this also speaks to the fact that those of us in the broadcast media really need to do our homework. And if we have on officials, we have to be prepared with facts to take them on when they say things that are inaccurate.
That's right. And it, too many times, of course, hosts want to be pleasant and not be seen as contentious and you know, impartial, or rather not impartial. And so, you know, they get away with it. They get away with their lies, as Mark said, and they repeat them often enough where they become accepted wisdom. So I gave a speech recently to the California Newspapers Association, and I said to them, it's time. These are not normal times. We have a president elect at that point who has declared war on us, and we have to take not just defensive action, but offensive action. And that means taking a much more aggressive view of our jobs, going out looking for the myriad, I think, crimes that are probably, you know, just under the surface in this incoming administration, the tax dodging, the corruption, and so on. I'm sure this is going to be one of the most corrupt administrations in American history. And so that, you know, again, you know, compels us to be aggressive investigators.
Well, on Thursday, the ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act request of the Trump era seeking documents related to potential conflicts of interest relating to business and family connections. The ACLU says this is unprecedented. David Talbot is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. His column runs three times a week. He's also author of The Devil's Chessboard. Mark Danner is a veteran journalist, author of Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, and Craig Aaron is president of Free Press. Craig, David, and Mark, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you so much. And I hope you can tune in on Monday. This weekend, the Women's March on Washington is expecting 200,000 people to descend on the National Mall. Marches are also planned in 50 states across the country and over 60 countries around the world. So we'll be talking about that on Monday. Thanks for joining the special edition of Your Call. Thanks to Malihe Razazan, Helena Murphy, Stephanie Purcell, and David Latulipe. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.